I'm just going to begin because the topic of self-esteem is really a course for an entire semester. I've asked to speak on it with a three-part series that was an hour and 15 minutes each one. So 30 minutes is really introducing the topic. It's not really covering it and it's giving a credit, but we're going to open the conversation. Just to quickly introduce myself, I'm Professor Naomi Clapper, or Nachama Clapper, if you live in this community. I chair the Department of Psychology at Lander College. In addition to chairing the department, I'm director of their counseling services. I also have a private practice on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And today we're going to be speaking or opening the topic of self-esteem. And on the surface, this seems like a kind of self-help topic, because really, who wouldn't want more self-esteem? We think it would help us in our business, and we think it would help us in our relationships, in our career paths, in our social dynamics. But actually, self-esteem is a much deeper topic. As a therapist on the Upper West Side for many decades, I have to tell you that I see at the root of many serious issues and disorders and relationship problems a low self-esteem. People who don't believe in themselves or don't even like themselves. What would you think are some of the disorders that may have self-esteem, either low self-esteem, either causing the disorder or exacerbating the disorder? What are some that you might know of?
Eating disorders?
Absolutely, 100% eating disorders. Thank you. What else?
Addiction.
I'm sorry?
Addiction.
Addiction, absolutely. Substance abuse, thank you so much. What else? Anxiety disorder, social anxiety in particular. Dependent personality disorder, people who are in a toxic relationship where really they should be leaving, but they don't feel that they deserve better or that they can get better. So low self-esteem is not just a self-help topic, even though the library is full of self-help books about self-esteem. Low self-esteem is really a very serious issue that causes or exacerbates deeper psychological problems. But even on a less clinical issue, even on a much more like day-to-day within your family issue, low self-esteem causes people to not achieve what they would, what they could. The classic term in our vernacular of an underachiever. What does an underachiever mean? Why don't they achieve what they're capable of, what they innately have the potential to? Part of it is that they can't take the necessary risks in order to be successful. They are stagnated or stuck, pulled back by their low self-esteem. And what's behind low self-esteem? What are some of the things that cause it and that we could possibly do to instill better self-esteem in ourselves, in our spouses, in our children? We're going to be discussing today 6 pillars of self-esteem. And again, I have spoken about this for 3 series of lectures. There is a lot to say, and I'm going to be touching upon them without going in depth. It's almost like the keys of self-esteem as opposed to in-depth study, and perhaps one day in the future we'll have time to do more in-depth. But these are the 6 fundamental pillars. Research shows that people who have a low self-esteem have a different mindset than people who have a high self-esteem. What they call self-schema, which is our schemas are cognitive structures in our head that help us understand the world. So self-schemas are cognitive structures or ideas in our head that help us understand ourselves. But sometimes they don't help us, they actually hurt us. So what do you believe in yourself? Is it positive? Is it negative? Is it mixed? Is it holding you back? People who have a low self-esteem have cognitive beliefs or a mindset about themselves, and one of them is that they believe that if they have challenges in life, they don't have the knowledge, skills, abilities to handle what life throws at them. They feel vulnerable for what can go wrong, and therefore they stay in the safe zone and not in the risk zone necessary, because life is full of risks. Getting married is a huge leap in terms of risk. Taking a job that has to move away, making aliyah, things that you want to do to achieve your dreams are all risks. So underachievers or people with a low self-esteem are thinking along the lines of, I don't want to try for that promotion, because if I fail, it'll be a public failure and everyone will look at me and I won't be able to fix that. Or I don't want to go to that social singles event, that mixer, even though I'm a 28-year-old single and I should be going. Because if I go and I'm ignored, or I'm rejected. I don't know how to change that. I don't know how to make people like me if my first impression is bad. I don't know how to like get into a cliquey group. And therefore they feel vulnerable. They don't feel that they have the ability to change a situation, to survive a challenge, and they won't take risks. Not in their careers, not socially, not in terms of relationships. So in my practice, I work on people with low self-esteem. And one of the things we work on is this mindset about failure, about fear of failure. And I tell them that failure, we learn more from our successes, I'm sorry, than our failures than we do from our successes. That failure, as I started to say, is actually a tuition-free education. Because success, we know how to do that. Right? We know how to take that test, how to work that system, how to figure that out. There's no great lessons there. There's zero growth if we've done something successfully before and we do it again. But failure, we can take the lessons we learned from that and we can apply them. We can grow them. And we can use the startup culture because the startups now, everybody knows that 80, 90% of them, right, or 3 out of 4, depending on which statistic you draw from, fails. And then those people who are the CEOs come back. They don't just say, okay, I failed and I'm going to go with my tail between my legs because I was publicly ostracized. They are back, and I can give you names, but we don't have time, with companies that are better, that are stronger. So a famous developmental psychologist, Eric Erickson, has taught a theory that I think helps our mindset. Eric Erickson said that people are always developing. Not the way we think of just children and they develop and then they're set, like soft clay that hardens and then you can't change it. And not even adolescents, who we know are in a very important developmental stage. But people are growing from the minute they are born until the day they die. They are growing and they are changing constantly. And what's interesting is that with each life's challenge, with each stage of life, they learn new skills. They learn new, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
It wasn't distracting at all. And even if we mess up, and how we mess up with that challenge, right? How we extract ourselves from a marriage that wasn't the right thing for us. How we pull out of a catastrophe and rebound. How we handle getting fired and then rebuilding our career. We grow and we develop skills and abilities and courage and grit that we didn't know we had or perhaps we didn't even have. So we are developing with each of life's stages things that we didn't have before. And there are some very young people in this room, but people who are in their 50s and above, which you don't have to raise your hand, I told you I wasn't going to call on you, know what I'm talking about. There are things that you can do, wisdom that you have, things that don't bother you that you would do now that in 20 you wouldn't have been able to do, or you wouldn't have been able to have the resiliency from without this perspective and without your life lessons. So we take that confidence, and we generalize it. We apply it to our lives. If you, for example, go to a new high school and you don't know anyone, this happened to me personally in 11th grade. The middle of 11th grade, we moved to New York. I went to Central Manhattan, which was at the time a very cliquey school. I don't know what it's like now. I didn't know a soul. The first 3 days I came home, I told my mother I didn't use my voice the entire day. The teachers didn't call on me. The kids didn't talk to me. I didn't use my voice. And it was excruciating. But eventually, by the end of 11th grade, I found courage that I didn't know I had, and I made the first move, and I made friends. And when I moved on to college, and then to move into different communities, I took that confidence in me of not being frozen to walk into a community in a place where I didn't know anybody. Because I said, I can make friends. Somehow, I can overcome cliquey situations and prove myself to be likable. That feeling that you're not helpless or that you doubt your ability, that frozen feeling is something when you try challenges in small steps, you gain that kind of confidence. And if you didn't have that, if you never had to try to break into a new social situation, if your parents made sure you were always with your chevra in every year of school and in camp, and you stayed in the New York area or wherever you were raised, and you didn't break out, and you moved back into the community in which you were raised, which to some people is like their dream, right? If you were ever thrown into a social situation where you didn't know anyone, it would be very frightening for you because you wouldn't have that confidence. Now, tiger moms in the community that we read about do not hold a candle to Jewish parents, right? We invented tiger moms, right? We are so involved in the details of our kids' life, and we sometimes want to pave the way for them and make sure that everything is smooth and they don't have to struggle. And parents do try and make their children have the same chever every year, every camp, so they never suffer the pangs of rejection. But how do they develop new skills if they are always having the way paved for them? Social skills, academic skills, cleaning up a mess that they made, and I don't mean their rooms, like a real mess. I have met in my practice men and women who never faced rejection, never faced a real challenge, never learned that important task, and now they're dating or they're going out in the job market where most of the time it ends in rejection until you get that perfect fit where you want and they want, or you finally get that job where they want you. There are many, many rejections in the job market, and they never were taught how to handle that rejection and not internalize it and not have it be traumatic for them. That's not healthy development, to shield our children from the chance to learn how to figure things out. And if they learn from you when they're young how to face some of life's challenges instead of you clearing the way from them, they've learned that important skill. And they learn that when things go wrong, they don't crumble. They dust themselves up, off. They pick themselves up. They survive. The child who failed a test and the parent, instead of calling the teacher, sat down with the child and said, okay, this is what you're going to do. Tomorrow you're going to ask the teacher to sit down with you during her lunchtime, during your lunchtime, and you're going to go over what you did wrong, and you're going to learn from it. That is the child that when they fail their first performance appraisal at work, will go to the boss and sit down with them and learn from it instead of saying, I hate this job, I knew I wasn't right for this job anyway. And they're the ones who, if they get fired, will figure out a plan and will go and start networking and pick themselves up and dust themselves off and forge ahead instead of just withdrawing into a depression because they were always the golden boy or girl and now for the first time they're not. So we have to along the way learn that things don't work out, we are rejected and we survive. And not everyone is going to invite me to the birthday parties or the bar mitzvahs, and that doesn't mean I'm unlovable. So when they date, and not everyone wants to go out on a second date with them, or when they go into the job market and they get no after no after no before they get their first job, they face that inevitable rejection, they won't fall apart. So pillar one is really, it's not what you do for your children, it's what you teach them to do for themselves. To face some of these challenges in baby steps early on so that they feel capable to handle life stress. And interestingly, if you feel capable and you don't feel so vulnerable, right, you have less anxiety, which may explain why studies show that people who have a high level of self-esteem also have lower levels of anxiety than people with low self-esteem, because they really have navigated the world successfully during stressful situations. And they've developed what psychology calls self-efficacy, which is the belief in yourself to handle stressful situations. That breeds self-esteem. I'm going to move on. There's a lot more to say about this, but for the sake of time, I'm going to skip to the second pillar of self-esteem. And since we mentioned, by the way, that people with low self-esteem leads to underachieving, which is what I discussed at the beginning, I want to share with you a very interesting study about people with a high level of self-esteem for a minute. You may even call them overachievers, astronauts, presidents, prime ministers, self-made millionaires, and to no surprise, these people have a very high level of self-esteem. But what was surprising was there was a statistically disproportionate number of them who were first-born children. Why? So this was explored more in depth. For those of you who are not first-born children, and obviously we can only have one first-born child ourselves, I'll tell you what characteristic really made them so successful, correlated to their success. It was not the amount of time that parents spent with them even, and it was not of the amount of money spent on SAT tutors, and it was not their education. In fact, most of them were not Ivy League educated. It was the amount of independence they were given growing up, the expectation of solving their own challenges. The firstborn children had more independence and were forced to have more self-sufficiency expected for them than other children. Which makes sense, because when the subsequent children arrive, the parents need the older child to handle things for themselves. And that correlating variable of independence led to self-esteem and their subsequent success. And it wasn't just the message, go and figure things out, though honestly, between you and me, that does sometimes work out very well. It wasn't just that message, go and figure things out, but training in the problem solving. Rather than clear the decks for them, the parents would teach them problem solving, role playing, this is how you're going to do it. You call them. I'm not going to call them and get you that connection. You're going to call, you're going to introduce yourself, and you're going to say such and such, let's practice, okay, you go. So that's the first pillar. The second pillar is linked to the urban legend, or I guess in Teaneck we'll have to call it the suburban legend, that parents think that if they shower their children with praise, especially if they're doing well, and they give them trophies, like we have trophies for just being part of the team, what they call trophies for showing up, and they hang report cards on the refrigerator, that that will lead to high self-esteem. Actually, the literature shows that it could have a boomerang effect. It could have just the opposite effect. Because if people's self-esteem is linked to grades or any other system where it's other people's appraisal of them, other people think they're pretty, other people think they're smart, that it actually makes self-esteem very vulnerable because you depend on other people's evaluation of you always. And they don't really have control over that rubric. Haven't you ever taken, thinking back to college, a comp one or a class, like an intro class, and in that comp one, the teacher loved your writing. They thought you were the most creative writer with your dangling half-finished sentences or your run-on sentences. Then you move into comp two and you have a different teacher and they hate your writing. You're doing the same thing and instead of A's, you're getting C's because they hate run-on sentences and they hate half-finished sentences for dramatic effect, right? They're methodical. And we learn that the rubric is arbitrary. I've been chairing the Department of Psychology for 10 years. I am in charge of the grading system of everyone in my department. I've been teaching for 29 years. And I always tell my students, if people, well, not my students at school, my kids rather, if you knew how arbitrary grades were, the students would just give it up right now, right? You can have a really miserable grader, and you can have a very easy grader, right? People have taken classes. They know what I'm talking about. It's arbitrary. We don't have control over that. When we link self-esteem to others' judgments of ourselves, what happens when the grades go down, right? Our self-esteem plummets. Or when they lose that prestigious job on which their self-esteem was built, right? Or when they're not the prettiest person as they get older. These are variables they cannot control. And I have a pet peeve. I don't like when you hear a therapist and they start saying, my patient this, my patient that, because honestly, I feel like you never know who people know. And even if you change the details to protect the innocent, it's very easy to give away information. But so I'm not going to talk about case studies, but every therapist everywhere always has one person in their case load or many that as a young person, their self-esteem was built on either boys really liking them or being very pretty. And that was the only thing their self-esteem was built on. And as they age, their self-esteem really crumbles to the point that sometimes they end up reclusive or bitter. You cannot have your self-esteem built on other people. Even if you were in high school valedictorian and as smart as can be, then you go to the Ivy League world and you realize there are a lot of smart people out there. So what is the solution? The solution is to encourage and reinforce things that they can control. Perseverance, their effort, hard work, time management, choosing to be kind, choosing not to be selfish, right? To encourage and reinforce what they can control. Saying things like, I like the way you attacked that project over the whole week, not waiting till the last minute, encouraging their time management. You put so many hours into that science project. It was so well prepared, encouraging effort. You spent the whole afternoon helping her instead of going with your friends. That was such a kind choice. Chesed. Because these are things they can control. And focusing on the things that they can control, perseverance, effort, being kind, choosing to do the right thing, doing to do the ethical thing and not cheat if their whole grade is cheating and then subsequently the whole grade is getting a better grade than them, right? Those things are internalized into self-esteem that people cannot take away from them. Never equate self-esteem with grades in their head. They could have the best researched, the best prepared science project in the whole room, but if it's on stem cell research and the committee is against stem cell research, they're not going to win the science project, right? The smartest doesn't always win. The truth is that I see in life, from my children who are now after college, that it's not grades, but the ability to sustain effort and have perseverance and manage your time well that does build success. So I want to move on beyond parenting, because parenting is not the only variable. There are a lot of variables that build self-esteem, many environmental variables. And I'd like to start this next topic by asking you to raise your hand if you know someone who does not know what they have going for them, that you feel that they would rate themselves lower than who they are. Raise your hand. Most people know someone, right? So I have had the privilege of teaching at both YU and Stern and then Lander College, which is also separate. When I teach social psychology, I always ask this question. And I guarantee you that 100% of the women raise their hand. And the men, 30 to 40%, I would say, on average, raise their hand, right? What is that? Why is there such a confidence gap? Gilligan, who is an educator, not a psychologist, wrote a wonderful book about high school students filled with research about just this topic, about the confidence gap. In elementary school, girls are much better, more motivated, more natural students than boys on average. But their confidence, once they reach high school, plummets. And their scores do as well, but not as much, unfortunately, as their confidence. And there are many interesting studies, but one that really demonstrates this well that I like, having worked with both men and women, is one that tracks students in an academic competition. And when men compete, young boys rather, high school students, compete against men, they predict their scores accurately. And when women compete against women, young women, they predict their scores accurately. But when the men competed against the women, the men overestimated that what their outcome would be, and the women underestimated what their outcome would be. Neither of them were accurate. This confidence gap, where the girls underestimate their abilities and the boys overestimate, had overconfidence their ability, and I could see from your faces, this is not a big surprise to some of you who have young men and women in your house. This confidence gap was very concerning. So Gilligan conducted a very provocative experiment where she took a seventh grade social studies curriculum, which is the cliff's edge right before the confidence of the girl seems to plummet. And if you have daughters at home, it's not accurate. It could be a year earlier, a year later, but that seems to be, on average, the cliff's edge. And the social studies curriculum before then had been completely male-dominated. World leaders, explorers, presidents, and they became completely female dominated. That year, the boys and girls in that seventh grade learned only about female prime ministers, right? Congresswomen, science breakthroughs by female leaders. I have the list of who they used. If you are teaching social studies and would like to change the curriculum, I have the list of all the scientific women, the women scientists who made the breakthroughs, all the prime ministers, unfortunately that's a much shorter list, who made those breakthroughs. In the follow-up studies of these students, throughout high school, the girls' confidence stayed level and did not drop the same way the other students in the other classes with the other curriculum did, right? And it was only a one-year curriculum. I guess once you speak about Indira Gandhi, Margaret Thatcher, Golden Mayer, like you kind of run out of prime ministers at a certain point, right? But wow, look at the effects of the environment, the school environment, in just 1 year, right? Because parents, we are an important layer, if you want to use the image of a lasagna in terms of self-esteem. We're that foundational layer. But then there's school, and there's friends, and there's teachers who can do a lot of damage, as you well know, and social comparison, where we learn about ourselves by just comparing ourselves to our peers. So we have to be very honest when we pick a school environment. Are they consistent with the messages that we are trying to instill in ourselves, in our children? Are they encouraging the students, or are they treating them like chayas that need to be contained? Are the teachers showing respect for them, or are they publicly embarrassing them? Alan Dershowitz, who is a Harvard attorney, who seems to have a lot of confidence, right? He wrote A Case for Israel, by the way, openly discussed his high school experiences in a lecture. And he said he went to BTA, and he was in the lowest track, in a track they lovingly called the garbage track. This was not a term coined by the students. It was a term coined by the administration. And when he graduated, the principal came over to him and said, Alan, you have a big mouth, not so much brains. Either you can be a lawyer or a reform rabbi. Now, Alan clearly got messages of self-esteem and independence from other sources. His mother was widowed young. He had to be much more independent than the average classmate of his. And he had developed a strong self-esteem. He had other variables. But look, not everyone's self-esteem is strong enough to handle that kind of message from the school. And 40, 50 years later, he still remembers that vote of no confidence from the principal. His sharing it as a cute vignette is almost like his revenge, like, look at me now, right? Different schools, and this does not correlate at all with hashkafa. I would even like to say it did, because then you would have an easy way to find the right schools, right? But it doesn't correlate with hashkafa. It sends very different types of messages to the students. As a professor in college, I am shocked what students tell me that they endured during their high school careers. Students have told me that they were in the lowest track in high school, and they literally, the lowest track, where the honor students were the golden children, they were given like the best teachers, air-conditioned room, and the lowest tracks was literally put in the basement with the worst teachers that no one could believe. They were burnt out when their parents had them 30 years ago, and they still are there, and with no air conditioning and no focus. So the third pillar of self-esteem is to find environments, schools, camps that make your child feel respected for their strengths, that are consistent with your messages that you're trying to give them. If your child is not academic, but very sweet or very talented, you can't put them in a school where the honors kids are the golden children and everyone else is a tuition dollar, right? If they're talented, does the school play? Is that something the administration respects? If they're athletic, does the school put a lot of credence into their sports? Do they even have sports teams? Right? If they're chesed, does the school newsletter talk about their Hurricane Sandy cleanup and all their chesed projects that they do? And you have to be honest, because sometimes parents are alumni or they are connected to the school, they're big supporters. That's part of mechanech na'ar al pi darko. So the fourth pillar, and I'm sorry that I'm going quickly again, I said each of these could be really an entire lecture. The fourth pillar is that we need to focus on your child's own uniqueness and find ways to feel confident for something that they are naturally good at. And here's the talent. That talent, that skill, that ability may not be on your mattering map at all. You may be a real academic powerhouse. Your poster may be Ivy League or bust for your children, but your child is not in honors and they're not academically gifted, but they're great at soccer. And soccer seems like a waste of time for you, right? You'd much rather them take tutoring and get into the honors class. But that soccer may be helping their self-esteem in ways you cannot imagine, right? Socializing him in great life lessons, going back to the beginning to pillar one, lessons of being part of a team, being a good sport when you lose, valuable lessons. In fact, I would argue that being part of a losing team has more valuable life lessons than being part of a winning team, even though you wouldn't think of it, watching the parents at any Little League game, right? My husband coached Little League in Teaneck, and he and the other coach who had the same mindset as him allowed kids with special needs to be part of their team so that these kids with special needs would have the experience of playing on a Little League team. And the teammates suffered a lot of losses because the kids were, you know, spacing out or not really as coordinated as some of their peers, but they learned such powerful life lessons from that. The literature on kids at risk, since you mentioned substance abuse as and linking to low self-esteem, the literature with kids at risk shows a huge proportion of kids, a disproportionate amount, couldn't happen statistically just by chance, are kids with learning disabilities. Because the insecurity and feelings of failure in communities or in academic environments that so values academic success or learning, the ability to learn, that makes them more vulnerable, their low self-esteem to peer influences, even, unfortunately, deviant ones. So we need to find a way to make them feel good for what they can naturally do. Don't cancel soccer to get more tutors. The fifth pillar of self-esteem is avoiding perfectionism. Now, I know we have very high expectations for our children, sometimes almost unachievable expectations. I hear students sitting and talking about how their parents want them to be exceedingly successful, but very humble, right? Almost paradoxical expectations for their children. But striving for that perfection, almost paradoxically, can lead to lower self-esteem. Because perfectionistic messages are always setting your child up to fail no matter how good they are at something. Perfectionism is black and white thinking. There are many adults who have not outgrown the black and white thinking of children or the black and white thinking of adolescents. And the adolescent brain is its own very interesting lecture that we do not have time for. But adolescents, because their executive functioning is not fully developed, their sort of the frontal lobe is basically still asleep and their brain is changing, they really think in black and white terms. So they feed into this kind of very good or very bad reaction that their parents have. They internalize it, and it becomes a voice of self-criticism, like planting a microchip in your child's head, like in a sci-fi movie, and their microchip is just constantly negative self-talk. I see in my practice a lot of young adults who suffer from depression and anxiety. I would say that and relationship issues are the most common issues I see in my private practice. And at the root of this anxiety and depression is very low self-esteem. And you hear an underlying constant barrage of negative self-talk. They are their own worst enemies. You shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have done that. That was so stupid. I'm such an idiot. Where do they have that from? Now, sometimes parents, without realizing it, with the very best of intentions, the very best, because parents want them, of course, to maximize their potential and achieve all they can achieve. So they create these environments where they're scanning to improve and correct constantly. Stand up straight, shake their hand, don't do that. You know, go back and ask if you can get the extra 5 points on the grade with extra credit, right? I get it, I have children. We want them to be all they can be. We don't have them in our homes for that long. We have a lot of work to do. I'm right there with you. But this constant correcting and criticism for some children is internalized. It's not the way. It has a boomerang effect. I have many students who are frozen, really frozen in the next stage of life, whether it's risks of relationships or risks of careers. And they say, my parents said, if you can't do it well, don't do it at all. And the most well-intended parent can say that. But perfectionistic messages create the self-critical voice in their head that really stops them in their track and makes them afraid to take risks or contributes to anxiety. And the sixth, and perhaps the most important variable in self-esteem is what I call unconditional love. And it's connected to this very critical, constantly correcting voice and how your children or your spouse could misconstrue these suggestions that you're constantly making to try and help them. This unconditional love is not, you know, Johnny, you know, you're riding your bike on the piano again. You know, it's not letting them do whatever they want. We know that kids need boundaries, right? It's healthy to have limits. And love without limits, honestly, does not prepare the child for the real world, which is something we discussed in Pillar 1. But this pillar is the child's knowledge that even if they mess up, they are lovable. They'll still be loved. This approach is founded on the theory of humanistic psychology. If anyone learned about Maslow, basically the theory that people are born already wanting to desire to be all they can be. You don't have to push them to self-actualize. You just have to not mess it up for them, right? That innately they want that. A little baby crawling around doesn't say, this is safe, I'm close to the ground. They're all walking, but I think I'll stay right there. They like walking and falling. Or if you want to try an experiment, if you have access to a two-year-old, just sit down with them and start building next to them blocks, right? They start copying you. You're not saying, do exactly like I do, like on an IQ test, right? You're just building. They try and do what you're doing. Then they get frustrated, so they knock it down. Because their inner standard is saying, I want to keep up. I want to do what they're doing. I want to aspire to great block building, right? That's the innate way. But what happens to the underachiever then? Why aren't they developing to be the most they can be? Why are they afraid to try? Perhaps, as we discussed in the first pillar, they weren't given the opportunity in baby steps to mess up, to try and to fail, and to pick themselves up and do it again. I always say to my children, Hashem et Adam v'Chava, and they messed up, right? We can mess up. It's okay to make mistakes. Or perhaps the second reason they're frozen and afraid to try is because they're immobilized by the fear from those very perfectionistic messages that they have internalized, the sort of critical eye that their parents had on them that they've swallowed. Or perhaps the third possibility is that they were given conditional love messages inadvertently, right? So many well-meaning parents will look at their children and try and mold them, but by molding them, they're using whatever control features they can. So if they're mad at their child, they don't look at them, or they don't speak to them, or they speak curtly to them, and then they're very loving to the other child who is doing what they want, or acting what they want, or believing the same way that the family believes. Your relationship with your children is one of the most important developmental influences. Parents mold their children, and they mistakenly think that part of the molding is sometimes to hold back on love until they're doing everything right, and then heap all that reward and praise onto them. But actually, that conditional love makes the child feel more vulnerable, more isolated, because if they don't do something right, they risk so much. They don't just risk the parent's disappointment, they risk their parent actually possibly not loving them less. So this last pillar is that we need to create a climate that has unconditional love, that you can have limits about how they dress or how they behave, but there's a very big difference between saying, please change, and you're dressed like a slob or you're dressed like a disgrace, right? It's not setting a standard, it's actually a message of that unconditional love. Or saying that's not a wise choice is different than saying you're an idiot. So I'm going to close with that chazal that says the left hand pushes away while the right hand brings closer. That is the image of unconditional love. That the left hand is adjusting and straightening and the right hand is bringing them into a hug. It's when your child has failed or embarrassed themselves or is perhaps going off the derech that they need more love. And more, we're here for you, we know you messed up, because I know you as parents, you would get them the best psychologist, lawyer, you know, social worker, whatever they need to help them. Those messages are what help build a child's self-esteem and help them prepare for the life. I hope you're able to incorporate some of these into your hearts, into your homes, into your children's hearts, and I want to thank you for your time, and thank you for coming. Have a great day.